I did at the time, I said, but I was disappointed because he had such beautiful manners. I took another sip of eau de vie and pitied the old man and looked at Picasso's nude of the girl with the basket of flowers. I had not started the conversation and thought it had become a little dangerous. There were almost never any pauses in a conversation with Miss Stein, but we had paused, and there was something she wanted to tell me, and I filled my glass. "You know nothing about any of this, really, Hemingway," she said. "You've met known criminals and sick people and vicious people. The main thing is that the act male homosexuals commit is ugly and repugnant, and afterwards they are disgusted with themselves. They drink, take drugs to palliate this, but they are disgusted with the act, and they are always changing partners and cannot be really happy." "I see. In women, it is the opposite. They do nothing that they are disgusted by, and nothing that is repulsive, and afterwards they are happy, and they can lead happy lives together."
"I see," I said. "But what about so-and-so?"
"She's vicious," Miss Stein said. "She's truly vicious. So she can never be happy except with new people. She corrupts people."
"I understand." "You're sure you understand?" There were so many things to understand in those days, and I was glad when we talked about something else. The park was closed, so I had to walk down along it to the Rue de Vaugirard and around the lower end of the park. It was sad when the park was closed and locked, and I was sad walking around it instead of through it, and in a hurry to get home to the Rue Cardinal Lemoine. The day had started out very brightly, too. I would have to work hard tomorrow. Work could cure almost anything, I believed then, and I believe it now. Then all I had to be cured of, I believed Miss Stein felt, was youth and loving my wife. I was not at all sad when I got home to the Rue Cardinal Lemoine and told my newly acquired knowledge to my wife. And we were happy in the night with our own knowledge we already had and other new knowledge we had acquired in the mountains. 3. Shakespeare and Company. In those days, there was no money to buy books. Books you borrowed from the rental library of Shakespeare and Company, which was the library and bookstore of Sylvia Beach at 12 Rue de l'Odéon. On a cold, windswept street, this was a lovely, warm, cheerful place, with a big stove in winter, tables and shelves of books. New books in the window, and photographs on the wall of famous writers, both dead and living. The photographs all looked like snapshots, and even the dead writers looked as though they had really been alive. Sylvia had a lively, very sharply cut face, brown eyes that were as alive as a small animal's and as gay as a young girl's, and wavy brown hair that was brushed back from her fine forehead and cut thick below her ears and at the line of the collar of the brown velvet jacket she wore. She had pretty legs, and she was kind, cheerful, and interested, and loved to make jokes and gossip. No one that I ever knew was nicer to me. I was very shy when I first went into the bookshop, and I did not have enough money on me to join the rental library. She told me I could pay the deposit any time I had the money, and made me out a card and said I could take as many books as I wished. There was no reason for her to trust me. She did not know me, and the address I had given her, 74 Rue Cardinal Lemoine, could not have been a poorer one. But she was delightful and charming and welcoming, and behind her, as high as the wall and stretching out into the back room which gave onto the inner court of the building, were the shelves and shelves of the richness of the library. I started with Turgenev and took the two volumes of A Sportsman's Sketches and an early book of D.H. Lawrence. I think it was Sons and Lovers, and Sylvia told me to take more books if I wanted. I chose the Constance Garnett edition of War and Peace and The Gambler and Other Stories by Dostoevsky. "You won't be back very soon if you read all that," Sylvia said. "I'll be by to pay," I said. "I have some money in the flat."
"I didn't mean that," she said. "You pay whenever it's convenient."
"When does Joyce come in?" I asked.
"If he comes in, it's usually very late in the afternoon," she said.
Haven't you ever seen him?
We've seen him at Michaud's eating with his family, I said. But it's not polite to look at someone when they are eating, and Michaud's is expensive.
Do you eat at home?
Mostly now, I said. We have a good cook.
There aren't any restaurants in your immediate quarter, are there?
No. How did you know?
Larbeau lived there, she said. He liked it very much, except for that.
The nearest good cheap place to eat is over by the Pantheon.
I don't know that quarter. We eat at home. You and your wife must come sometime.
Wait until you see if I pay you, I said. But thank you very much.
Don't read too fast, she said.
At home in our two-room flat that had no hot water and no inside toilet facilities except an antiseptic portable container that was not uncomfortable to anyone who was used to a Michigan outhouse, but which was a cheerful gay flat with a fine view and a good mattress and springs for a comfortable bed on the floor, well and tastefully covered, and pictures that we liked on the walls, I told my wife about the wonderful place I had found.
But Tati, you must go by this afternoon and pay, she said.
Sure I will, I said. We'll both go. And then we'll walk down by the river and along the quay.
Let's walk down the Rue de Seine and look in all the galleries and in the windows of the shops.
Sure. We can walk anywhere, and we can stop at some new cafe where we don't know anyone and nobody knows us and have a drink.
We can have two drinks.
Then we can eat somewhere.
No. Don't forget we have to pay the library.
We'll come home and eat here, and we'll have a lovely meal and drink bone from the cooperative you can see right out of the window there with the price of the bone on the window. And afterwards we'll read and then go to bed and make love.
And we'll never love anyone else but each other.
No, never.
What a lovely afternoon and evening.
Now we'd better have lunch.
I'm very hungry, I said. I worked at the café on a café crème.
How did it go, Tati?
I think all right. I hope so. What do we have for lunch?
Little radishes and good foie de veau with mashed potatoes and an endive salad. Apple tart.
And we're going to have all the books in the world to read, and when we go on trips, we can take them.
Would that be honest?
Sure.
Does she have Henry James, too?
Sure.
My, she said, we're lucky that you found the place.
We're always lucky, I said. And like a fool, I did not knock on wood. There was wood everywhere in that apartment to knock on, too.
4. People of the Seine. There were many ways of walking down to the river from the top of the Rue Cardinal Lemoine where we lived. The shortest one was straight down the street, but it was steep, and it brought you out after you hit the flat part and crossed the busy traffic of the beginning of the Boulevard Saint-Germain onto a dull part where there was a dull, windy stretch of riverbank with the Allauvin on your right. This was not like any other Paris market, but was a sort of bonded warehouse where wine was stored against the payment of taxes, and was as cheerless from the outside as a military depot or a prison camp. Across the branch of the Seine was the Île Saint-Louis, with the narrow streets and the old, tall, beautiful houses. And you could go over there, or you could turn left and walk along the quay, with the length of the Île Saint-Louis and then Notre-Dame and Île de la Cité opposite as you walked. In the bookstalls along the quay, you could sometimes find American books that had just been published for sale very cheaply. The Tour d'Argent restaurant had a few rooms above the restaurant that they rented in those days, giving the people who lived there a discount in the restaurant. And if the people who lived there left any books behind, there was a bookstall not far along the quay where the valet de chambre sold them, and you could buy them from the proprietress for a very few francs. She had no confidence in books written in English, paid almost nothing for them, and sold them for a small and quick profit.
"Are they any good?"
she asked me after we had become friends.
"Sometimes one is."
"How can anyone tell?"
"I can tell when I read them."
"But still, it is a form of gambling, and how many people can read English?"
Save them for me and let me look them over.
No, I can't save them. You don't pass regularly. You stay away too long at a time. I have to sell them as soon as I can. No one can tell if they are worthless. If they turn out to be worthless, I would never sell them.
How do you tell a valuable French book?
First, there are the pictures. Then it is a question of the quality of the pictures. Then it is the binding. If a book is good, the owner will have it bound properly. All books in English are bound, but bound badly. There is no way of judging them.
After that bookstall near the Tour d'Argent, there were no others that sold American and English books until the Quai des Grands Augustins. There were several from there on, to pass the Quai Voltaire, that sold books they bought from employees of the Left Bank hotels, and especially the Hotel Voltaire, which had a wealthier clientele than most. One day I asked another woman stallkeeper, who was a friend of mine, if the owners ever sold the books.
No, she said. They are all thrown away. That is why one knows they have no value.
Friends give them to them to read on the boats.
Doubtless, she said. They must leave many on the boats.
They do, I said. The line keeps them and binds them, and they become the ship's libraries.
That's intelligent, she said.
At least they are properly bound, then.
Now a book like that would have value.
I would walk along the quay when I had finished work or when I was trying to think something out. It was easier to think if I was walking and doing something or seeing people doing something that they understood. At the head of the Ile de la Cité, below the Pont Neuf, where there was the statue of Henri IV, the island ended in a point like the sharp bow of a ship, and there was a small park at the water's edge with fine chestnut trees, some huge and spreading. And in the currents and backwaters that the Seine made flowing past, there were excellent places to fish. You went down a stairway to the park and watched the fishermen there and under the great bridge. The good spots to fish changed with the height of the river, and the fishermen used long, jointed cane poles, but fished with very fine leaders and light gear and quill floats, and baited the piece of water that they fished expertly. They always caught some fish, and often they made excellent catches of the dace-like fish that were called goujons. They were delicious fried whole, and I could eat a plateful. They were plump and sweet-fleshed with a finer flavor than fresh sardines even, and were not at all oily, and we ate them bones and all. One of the best places to eat them was at an open-air restaurant built out over the river at Bas Moudon, where we would go when we had money for a trip away from our quarter. It was called La Pêche Miraculeuse and had a splendid white wine that was sort of muscadet. It was a place out of a Maupassant story with the view over the river as Sisley had painted it. You did not have to go that far to eat goujons. You could get a very good friture on the Ile Saint-Louis. I knew several of the men who fished the fruitful parts of the Seine between the Ile Saint-Louis and the Square du Vert-Galant, and sometimes, if the day was bright, I would buy a liter of wine and a piece of bread and some sausage, and sit in the sun and read one of the books I had bought and watch the fishing. Travel writers wrote about the men fishing in the Seine as though they were crazy and never caught anything, but it was serious and productive fishing. Most of the fishermen were men who had small pensions, which they did not know then would become worthless with inflation, or keen fishermen who fished on their days or half-days off from work. There was better fishing at Charenton, where the Marne came into the Seine, and on either side of Paris, but there was very good fishing in Paris itself. I did not fish because I did not have the tackle, and I would rather save my money to fish in Spain. Then, too, I never knew when I would be through working, nor when I would have to be away, and I did not want to become involved in the fishing, which had its good times and its slack times. But I followed it closely, and it was interesting and good to know about, and it always made me happy that there were men fishing in the city itself, having sound, serious fishing, and taking a few friteurs home to their families. With the fishermen and the life on the river, the beautiful barges with their own life on board, the tugs with their smokestacks that folded back to pass under the bridges, pulling a tow of barges,
the great plane trees on the stone banks of the river, the elms and sometimes the poplars. I could never be lonely along the river. With so many trees in the city, you could see the spring coming each day until a night of warm wind would bring it suddenly in one morning. Sometimes the heavy cold rains would beat it back so that it would seem that it would never come and that you were losing a season out of your life. This was the only truly sad time in Paris because it was unnatural. You expected to be sad in the fall. Part of you died each year when the leaves fell from the trees and their branches were bare against the wind and the cold wintry light. But you knew there would always be the spring, as you knew the river would flow again after it was frozen. When the cold rains kept on and killed the spring, it was as though a young person had died for no reason. In those days, though, the spring always came, finally. But it was frightening that it had nearly failed. 5. A False Spring. When spring came, even the false spring, there were no problems except where to be happiest. The only thing that could spoil a day was people, and if you could keep from making engagements, each day had no limits. People were always the limiters of happiness, except for the very few that were as good as spring itself. In the spring mornings, I would work early while my wife still slept. The windows were open wide, and the cobbles of the street were drying after the rain. The sun was drying the wet faces of the houses that faced the window. The shops were still shuttered. The goatherd came up the street blowing his pipes, and a woman who lived on the floor above us came out onto the sidewalk with a big pot. The goatherd chose one of the heavy-bagged black milk goats and milked her into the pot while his dog pushed the others onto the sidewalk. The goats looked around, turning their necks like sightseers. The goatherd took the money from the woman and thanked her and went on up the street, piping, and the dog herded the goats on ahead, their horns bobbing. I went back to writing, and the woman came up the stairs with the goat milk. She wore her felt-soled cleaning shoes, and I only heard her breathing as she stopped on the stairs outside our door, and then the shutting of her door. She was the only customer for goat milk in our building. I thought I would go down and buy a morning racing paper. There was no quarter too poor to have at least one copy of a racing paper, but you had to buy it early on a day like this. I found one in the Rue Descartes at the corner of the Place Contrescarpe. The goats were going down the Rue Descartes, and I breathed the air in and walked back fast to climb the stairs and get my work done. I had been tempted to stay out and follow the goats down the early morning street, but before I started again, I looked at the paper. They were running at Enghien, the small, pretty, and larcenous track that was the home of the outsider. So that day after I had finished work, we would go racing. Some money had come from the Toronto paper that I did newspaper work for, and we wanted a long shot if we could find one. My wife had a horse one time at Auteuil named Chevredor that was 120-1 and leading by 20 lengths when he fell at the last jump with enough savings on him to... We tried never to think to do what. We were ahead on that year, but Chevredor would have... We didn't think about Chevredor. "Do we have enough money to really bet, Tati?" my wife asked. "No, we'll just figure to spend what we take. Is there something else you'd rather spend it for?" "Well," she said, "I know. It's been terribly hard, and I've been tight and mean about money."
"No," she said, "but..."
I knew how severe I had been and how bad things had been. The one who is doing his work and getting satisfaction from it is not the one the poverty is hard on. I thought of bathtubs and showers and toilets that flushed as things that inferior people to us had or that you enjoyed when you made trips, which we often made. There was always the public bathhouse down at the foot of the street by the river. My wife had never complained once about these things any more than she cried about Chevredor when he fell.
She had cried for the horse, I remembered, but not for the money. I had been stupid when she needed a gray lamb jacket and had loved it when she had bought it. I had been stupid about other things, too. It was all part of the fight against poverty that you never win except by not spending, especially if you buy pictures instead of clothes. But then we did not think ever of ourselves as poor. We did not accept it. We thought we were superior people, and other people that we looked down on and rightly mistrusted were rich. It had never seemed strange to me later on to wear sweatshirts for underwear to keep warm. It only seemed odd to the rich. We ate well and cheaply, and drank well and cheaply, and slept well and warm together and loved each other. "I think we ought to go," my wife said. "We haven't been for such a long time. We'll take a lunch and some wine. I'll make good sandwiches."
"We'll go on the train, and it's cheap that way. But let's not go if you don't think we should.
Anything we do today would be fun. It's a wonderful day. I think we should go."
"You wouldn't rather spend it some other way?"
"No," she said arrogantly. She had the lovely high cheekbones for arrogance. "Who are we, anyway?"
So we went out by the train from the Gare du Nord through the dirtiest and saddest part of town and walked from the siding to the oasis of the track. It was early, and we sat on my raincoat on the fresh-cropped grass bank and had our lunch and drank from the wine bottle and looked at the old grandstand, the brown wooden betting booths, the green of the track, the darker green of the hurdles, and the brown shine of the water jumps and the whitewashed stone walls and white posts and rails, the paddock under the new leafed trees, and the first horses being walked to the paddock. We drank more wine and studied the form in the paper, and my wife lay down on the raincoat to sleep with the sun on her face. I went over and found someone I knew from the old days at Saint Siro in Milano. He gave me 2 horses.
"Mind, they're no investment, but don't let the price put you off."
We won the first with half of the money that we had to spend, and he paid 12-1, jumping beautifully, taking command on the far side of the course and coming in 4 lengths ahead. We saved half of the money and put it away, and bet the other half on the second horse who broke ahead, led all the way over the hurdles, and on the flat just lasted to the finish line with the favorite gaining on him with every jump and the 2 whips flailing. We went to have a glass of champagne at the bar under the stand and wait for the prices to go up.
"My, but racing is very hard on people," my wife said. "Did you see that horse come up on him?"
"I can still feel it inside me."
"What will he pay?"
"The coat was 18-1, but they may have bet him at the last." The horses came by, ours wet, with his nostrils working wide to breathe, the jockey patting him.
"Poor him," my wife said. "We just bet."
We watched them go on by and had another glass of champagne, and then the winning came up. 85. That meant he paid 85 francs for 10.
"They must have put a lot of money on at the end," I said.
But we had made plenty of money, big money for us, and now we had spring and money, too. I thought that was all we needed. A day like that one, if you split the winnings 1/4 for each to spend, left a half for racing capital. I kept the racing capital secret and apart from all other capital, and there was racing at some track every day. Another day later that year, when we had come back from one of our voyages and had good luck at some track again, we stopped at Prunier on the way home, going in to sit at the bar after looking at all the clearly priced wonders in the window. We had oysters and crab Mexican with glasses of Sancerre. We walked back through the Tuileries in the dark and stood and looked through the Arc de Carousel up across the dark gardens with the lights of the Concorde behind the formal darkness and then the long rise of lights toward the Arc de Triomphe. Then we looked back toward the dark of the Louvre, and I said, "Do you really think that the 3 arches are in line?"
These two, and the Sirmione in Milano?
I don't know, Tati. They say so, and they ought to know.
Do you remember when we came out into the spring on the Italian side of the San Bernard after the climb and the snow, and you and Chink and I walked down all day in the spring to Aosta?
Chink called it across the San Bernard in street shoes. Remember your shoes?
My poor shoes. Do you remember us having fruit cup at Beefy's in the Galleria with Capri and fresh peaches and wild strawberries in a tall glass pitcher with ice?
That time was what made me wonder about the three arches.
I remember the Sirmione. It's like this arch.
Do you remember the Aigle, where you and Chink sat in the garden that day and read while I fished?
Yes, Tati.
I remembered the Rhone, narrow and gray and full of snow water, and the two trout streams on either side, the Stalkalper and the Rhone Canal. The Stalkalper was really clear that day, and the Rhone Canal was still murky.
Do you remember when the horse chestnut trees were in bloom, and how I tried to remember a story that Jim Gamble, I think, had told me about a wisteria vine and I couldn't remember it?
Yes, Tati. And you and Chink always talking about how to make things true, writing them and putting them rightly and not describe.
I remember everything.
Sometimes he was right, and sometimes you were right. I remember the lights and textures and the shapes you argued about.
Now we had come out of the gateway through the Louvre and crossed the street outside and were standing on the bridge, leaning on the stone and looking down at the river.
We all three argued about everything, and always specific things, and we made fun of each other.
I remember everything we ever did and everything we ever said on the whole trip, Hadley said.
I do, really, about everything. When you and Chink talked, I was included. It wasn't like being a wife at Miss Stein's.
I wish I could remember the story about the wisteria vine.
It wasn't important. It was the vine that was important, Tati.
Do you remember I brought some wine from Aigle home to the chalet? They sold it to us at the inn. They said it should go with the trout. We brought it wrapped in copies of La Gazette de Lausanne, I think.
The Sion wine was even better. Do you remember how Mrs. Gongesvish cooked the trout au bleu when we got back to the chalet? They were such wonderful trout, Tati.
And we drank the Sion wine and ate out on the porch with the mountainside dropping off below, and we could look across the lake and see the Dent du Midi with the snow half down it and the trees at the mouth of the Rhone where it flowed into the lake.
We always miss Chink in the winter and the spring.
Always. And I miss him now when it is gone.
Chink was a professional soldier and had gone out to Mons from Sandhurst.
I met him first in Italy, and he had been my best friend and then our best friend for a long time. He spent his leaves with us then. He's going to try to get leave this next spring. He wrote last week from Cologne.
I know. We should live in this time now and have every minute of it.
We're watching the water now as it hits this buttress.
Look what we can see when we look up the river.
We looked, and there it all was. Our river and our city and the island of our city.
We're too lucky, she said. I hope Chink will come.
He takes care of us.
He doesn't think so.
Of course not.
He thinks we explore together.
We do. But it depends on what you explore.
We walked across the bridge, and were on our own side of the river.
Are you hungry again? I said.
Us, talking and walking.
Of course, Tati. Aren't you?
Let's go to a wonderful place and have a truly grand dinner.
Where?
Michaud's.
That's perfect, and it's so close.
So we walked up the Rue des Saints-Pères to the corner of the Rue Jacob, stopping and looking in the windows at pictures and at furniture. We stood outside of Michaud's restaurant reading the posted menu. Michaud's was crowded, and we waited for people to come out, watching the tables where people already had their coffee.
We were hungry again from walking, and Michaud's was an exciting and expensive restaurant for us. It was where Joyce ate with his family then, he and his wife against the wall, Joyce peering at the menu through his thick glasses, holding the menu up in one hand. Nora by him, a hearty but delicate eater. Giorgio, thin, foppish, sleek-headed from the back. Lucia, with heavy curly hair. A girl not quite yet grown, all of them talking Italian. Standing there, I wondered how much of what we had felt on the bridge was just hunger. I asked my wife, and she said, "I don't know, Tati. There are so many sorts of hunger. In the spring, there are more. But that's gone now. Memory is hunger." I was being stupid, and looking in the window and seeing two tornado being served, I knew I was hungry in a simple way. "You said we were lucky today. Of course we were. But we had very good advice and information." She laughed. "I didn't mean about the racing. You're such a literal boy. I meant lucky in other ways." "I don't think Chink cares for racing," I said, compounding my stupidity. "No. He'd only care for it if he were riding." "Don't you want to go racing anymore?" "Of course. And now we can go whenever we want again." "But you really want to go?" "Of course. You do, don't you?" It was a wonderful meal at Michaud's after we got in. But when we had finished and there was no question of hunger anymore, the feeling that had been like hunger when we were on the bridge was still there when we caught the bus home. It was there when we came in the room, and after we had gone to bed and made love in the dark, it was there. When I woke with the windows open and the moonlight on the roofs of the tall houses, it was there. I put my face away from the moonlight into the shadow, but I could not sleep and lay awake thinking about it. We had both wakened twice in the night, and my wife slept sweetly now with the moonlight on her face. I had to try to think it out, and I was too stupid. Life had seemed so simple that morning when I had wakened and found the false spring and heard the pipes of the man with his herd of goats and gone out and bought the racing paper. But Paris was a very old city, and we were young, and nothing was simple there, not even poverty, nor sudden money, nor the moonlight, nor right and wrong, nor the breathing of someone who lay beside you in the moonlight. 6. The End of an Avocation. We went racing together many more times that year, and other years, after I had worked in the early mornings, and Hadley enjoyed it, and sometimes she loved it. But it was not the climbs in the high mountain meadows above the last forest, nor nights coming home to the chalet, nor was it climbing with Chink, our best friend, over a high pass into new country. It was not really racing, either. It was gambling on horses, but we called it racing. Racing never came between us. Only people could do that. But for a long time it stayed close to us like a demanding friend. That was a generous way to speak of it. The one who was so righteous about people and their destructiveness, tolerated this one that was the falsest, most beautiful, most exciting, vicious, and demanding because she could be profitable. To make it profitable was more than a full-time job, and I had no time for that. But I justified it to myself because I wrote it. Though in the end, when everything I had written was lost, there was only one racing story that was out in the mails that survived. I was going to races alone more now, and I was involved in them and getting too mixed up with them. I worked two tracks in their season when I could, Auteuil and Enghien. It took full-time work to try to handicap intelligently, and you could make no money that way. That was just how it worked out on paper. You could buy a paper that gave you that. You had to watch a jumping race from the top of the stands at Auteuil, and it was a fast climb up to see what each horse did, and see the horse that might have won and did not, and see why, or at least how, or maybe how he did not do what he could have done. You watched the prices and all the shifts of odds each time a horse you were following would start, and you had to know how he was working, and finally get to know when the stable would try with him. He always might be beaten when he tried, but you should know by then what his chances were. It was hard work, but at Auteuil it was beautiful to watch each day they raced when you could be there and see the honest races with the great horses, and you got to know the course as well as any place you had ever known. You knew many people, finally, jockeys and trainers and owners, and too many horses and too many things. You only, in principle, bet when you had a horse to bet on, but you sometimes found horses that nobody believed in except the men who trained and rode them that won race after race with you betting on them. You had to follow it very closely to really know anything. I stopped finally because it took too much time. I was getting too involved, and I knew too much about what went on at Enghien and at the flat racing tracks, too. When I stopped working on the races, I was glad, but it left an emptiness. By then, I knew that everything good and bad left an emptiness when it stopped. But if it was bad, the emptiness filled up by itself. If it was good, you could only fill it up by finding something better. I put the racing capital back into the general funds, and I felt relaxed and good. The day I gave up racing, I went over to the other side of the river and met my friend Mike Ward at the travel desk in the Guarantee Trust, which was then at the corner of the Rue des Italiens on the Boulevard des Italiens. I was depositing the racing capital, but I did not tell that to anyone. I didn't put it in the checkbook, though I still kept it in my head. "Want to go to lunch?" I asked Mike. "Sure, kid. Yeah, I can do it. What's the matter? Aren't you going to the track?" "No." We had lunch at the Square Louvois at a very good plain bistro with a wonderful white wine. Across the square was the Bibliothèque Nationale. "You never went to the track much, Mike," I said.
"No, not for quite a long time."
"Why did you lay off it?"
"I don't know," Mike said. "Yes, sure I do. Anything you have to bet on to get a kick isn't worth seeing."
"Don't you ever go out?"
"Sometimes to see a big race, one with great horses."
We spread pâté on the good bistro bread and drank the white wine.
"Did you follow them a lot, Mike?"
"Oh, yes."
"What do you see that's better?"
"Bicycle racing."
"Really?
You don't have to bet on it. You'll see.
That track takes a lot of time."
"Too much time. Takes all your time. I don't like the people."
I was very interested.
"Sure. You make out all right?"
"All right."
"Good thing to stop," Mike said.
"I've stopped."
"Hard to do.
Listen, kid, we'll go to the bike races sometime."
That was a new and fine thing that I knew little about. But we did not start it right away. That came later. It came to be a big part of our lives later when the first part of Paris was broken up. But for a long time it was enough just to be back in our part of Paris and away from the track and to bet on your own life and work and on the painters that you knew and not try to make your living gambling and call it by some other name. I have started many stories about bicycle racing, but have never written one that is as good as it is both on the indoor and outdoor tracks and on the roads. All that and the 6-day races are still to come. But I will get the Vélodrome d'Hiver with the smoky light of the afternoon and the high-banked wooden track and the whirring sound the tires made on the wood as the riders passed, the effort and the tactics as the riders climbed and plunged, each one a part of his machine. I will get the magic of the demi-fond, the noise of the motors with their rollers set out behind them that the entraîneurs rode, wearing their heavy crash helmets and leaning backward in their ponderous leather suits to shelter the riders who followed them from the air resistance. The riders in their lighter crash helmets bent low over their handlebars, their legs turning the huge gear sprockets and the small front wheels touching the roller behind the machine that gave them a shelter from the air resistance to ride in, and the duels that were more exciting than any racing, the putt-putting of the motorcycles and the riders elbow to elbow and wheel to wheel up and down and around at deadly speed until one man could not hold the pace and broke away, and the solid wall of air that he had been sheltered against hit him. There were so many kinds of racing. The straight sprints raced in heats or in match races, where the two riders would balance for long seconds on their machines for the advantage of making the other rider take the lead, and then the slow circling and the final plunge into the driving purity of speed. There were the programs of the team races of 2 hours, with a series of pure sprints in their heats to fill the afternoon. The lonely absolute speed events of one man racing an hour against the clock. The terribly dangerous and beautiful races of 100 kilometers on the big banked wooden 500-meter bowl of the Stade Buffalo. The outdoor stadium at Montrouge where they raced behind big motorcycles. Linard, the great Belgian champion that they called the Sioux for his profile, dropping his head to suck up cherry brandy from a rubber tube that connected with a hot water bottle under his racing shirt when he needed it toward the end, as he increased his savage speed. And the championships of France behind big motors of the 660-meter cement track of the Parc du Prince near Auteuil, the wickedest track of all, where Pauline and I saw that great rider Ganet fall and heard his skull crumple under the crash helmet as you crack an hard-boiled egg against a stone to peel it on a picnic. I must write the strange world of the six-day races and the marvels of the road racing in the mountains. French is the only language it has ever been written in properly, and the terms are all French, and that is what makes it so hard to write. But Mike was right about it. There is no need to bet. And it comes at another time in Paris. 7. Une génération perdue. It was easy to get into the habit of stopping in at 27 Rue de Fleurus late in the afternoon for the warmth and the great pictures and the conversation. Often Miss Stein would have no guests, and she was always very friendly, and for a long time she was affectionate. She loved to talk about people and places and things and food. When I had come back from trips that I had made to the different political conferences, or to the Near East or Germany for the Canadian paper and the news services that I did work for, she wanted me to tell her about all the amusing things that had happened. There were funny things always, and she liked them, and also what the Germans call gallows humor stories. She did not like to hear really bad nor tragic things, but no one does. And having seen them, I did not care to talk about them unless she wanted to know how the world was going. She wanted to know the gay part of how the world was going, never the real, never the bad. I was young and not gloomy, and there was always strange and comic things that happened in the worst time, and Miss Stein liked to hear these things. The other things I did not talk of and wrote by myself. When I had not come back from any trips and would stop in at the Rue de Fleurus after working, I would try sometimes to get Miss Stein to talk about books. When I was writing, it was necessary for me to read after I had written, to keep my mind from going on with the story I was working on. If you kept thinking about it, you would lose the thing that you were writing before you could go on with it the next day. It was necessary to get exercise, to be tired in my body, and it was very good to make love with whom you loved. That was better than anything. But afterwards, when you were empty, it was necessary to read in order not to think or worry about your work until you could do it again. I had learned already never to empty the well of my writing, but always to stop when there was still something there in the deep part of the well, and let it refill at night for
from the springs that fed it. To keep my mind off writing, sometimes after I had worked, I would read writers who were writing then, such as Aldous Huxley, D.H. Lawrence, or any who had books published that you could get from Sylvia Beach's library or find along the quay. "Huxley is a dead man," Miss Stein said. "Why do you want to read a dead man? Can't you see he is dead?" I could not see then that he was a dead man, and I said that his books amused me and kept me from thinking. "You should only read what is truly good or what is frankly bad. I've been reading truly good books all winter and all last winter, and I'll read them next winter, and I don't like frankly bad books." "Why do you read this trash? It is inflated trash, Hemingway, by a dead man." "I like to see what they are writing," I said, "and it keeps my mind off me doing it." "Who else do you read now?" "D.H. Lawrence," I said. "He wrote some very good short stories, one called The Prussian Officer. I tried to read his novels. He's impossible. He's pathetic and preposterous. He writes like a sick man." "I liked Sons and Lovers and The White Peacock," I said. "Maybe that, not so well. I couldn't read Women in Love." "If you don't want to read what is bad, and want to read something that will hold your interest and is marvelous in its own way, you should read Marie Belloc Lowndes." I had never heard of her, and Miss Stein loaned me The Lodger, that marvelous story of Jack the Ripper, and another book about murder at a place outside Paris that could only be Enghien-les-Bains. They were both splendid after-work books, the people credible and the action and the terror never false. They were perfect for reading after you had worked, and I read all the Mrs. Belloc Lowndes that there was. But there was only so much, and none as good as the first two, and I never found anything as good for that empty time of day or night until the first fine Simenon books came out. I think Miss Stein would have liked the good Simenon. The first one I read was either L'Écluse Numéro Un or La Maison du Canal. But I am not sure, because when I knew Miss Stein, she did not like to read French, although she loved to speak it. Janet Flanner gave me the first two Simenons I ever read. She loved to read French, and she had read Simenon when he was a crime reporter. In the 3 or 4 years that we were good friends, I cannot remember Gertrude Stein ever speaking well of any writer who had not written favorably about her work or done something to advance her career, except for Ronald Furbank and later Scott Fitzgerald. When I first met her, she did not speak of Sherwood Anderson as a writer, but spoke glowingly of him as a man and of his great, beautiful, warm Italian eyes and of his kindness and his charm. I did not care about his great, beautiful, warm Italian eyes, but I liked some of his short stories very much. They were simply written and sometimes beautifully written, and he knew the people he was writing about and cared deeply for them. Miss Stein did not want to talk about his stories, but always about him as a person. "What about his novels?" I asked her. She did not want to talk about Anderson's works any more than she would talk about Joyce. If you brought up Joyce twice, you would not be invited back. It was like mentioning one general favorably to another general. You learn not to do it the first time you made the mistake. You could always mention a general, though, that the general you were talking to had beaten. The general you were talking to would praise the beaten general greatly and go happily into detail on how he had beaten him. Anderson's stories were too good to make happy conversation. I was prepared to tell Miss Stein how strangely poor his novels were, but this would have been bad, too, because it was criticizing one of her most loyal supporters. When he wrote a novel finally called Dark Laughter, so terribly bad, silly, and affected that I could not keep from criticizing it in a parody, Miss Stein was very angry. I had attacked someone that was part of her apparatus. But for a long time before that, she was not angry. She herself began to praise Sherwood lavishly after he had cracked up as a writer.
She was angry at Ezra Pound because he had sat down too quickly on a small, fragile, and doubtless uncomfortable chair that it is quite possible he had been given on purpose and had either cracked or broken it. That finished Ezra at 27 Rue de Fleurus. That he was a great poet and a gentle and generous man and could have accommodated himself in a normal-sized chair was not considered. The reasons for her dislike of Ezra, skillfully and maliciously put, were invented years later. It was when we had come back from Canada, and while we were living in the Rue Notre-Dame des Champs, and Miss Stein and I were still good friends, that Miss Stein made the remark about the lost generation. She had some ignition trouble with the old Model T Ford she then drove, and the young man who worked in the garage and had served in the last year of the war had not been adept, or perhaps had not broken the priority of other vehicles, in repairing Miss Stein's Ford. Perhaps he had not realized the importance of Miss Stein's vehicle having the right of immediate repair. Anyway, he had not been sérieux and had been corrected severely by the patron of the garage after Miss Stein's protest. The patron had said to him, "You are all a génération perdue."
"That's what you are. That's what you all are," Miss Stein said. "All of you young people who served in the war, you are a lost generation."
"Really?" I said.
"You are," she insisted. "You have no respect for anything. You drink yourselves to death."
"Was the young mechanic drunk?" I asked.
"Of course not."
"Have you ever seen me drunk?"
"No, but your friends are drunk."
"I've been drunk," I said, "but I don't come here drunk."
"Of course not. I didn't say that."
"The boy's patron was probably drunk by 11 o'clock in the morning," I said. "That's why he makes such lovely phrases."
"Don't argue with me, Hemingway," Miss Stein said. "It does no good at all. You're all a lost generation, exactly as the garage keeper said."
Later, when I published my first novel, I tried to balance Miss Stein's quotation from the garage keeper with one from Ecclesiastes. But that night, walking home, I thought about the boy in the garage and if he had ever been hauled in one of those vehicles when they were converted to ambulances. I remembered how they used to burn out their brakes going down the mountain roads with a full load of wounded, and braking in low and finally using the reverse, and how the last ones were driven over the mountainside empty, so they could be replaced by big Fiats with a good H-shift and metal-to-metal brakes. I thought of Miss Stein and Sherwood Anderson and egotism and mental laziness versus discipline, and I thought, who is calling who a lost generation? Then, as I was getting up to the Closerie des Lilas, with a light on my old friend, the statue of Marshal Ney, with his sword out and the shadows of the trees on the bronze, and he alone there, and nobody behind him, and what a balls-up he'd made of Waterloo, I thought that all generations were lost by something, and always had been, and always would be. And I stopped at the Lilas to keep the statue company, and drank a cold beer before going home to the flat over the sawmill. But sitting there with the beer, watching the statue, and remembering how many days Ney had fought, personally, with the rear guard on the retreat from Moscow that Napoleon had ridden away from in the coach with Caulaincourt, I thought of what a warm and affectionate friend Miss Stein had been, and how beautifully she had spoken of Apollinaire and of his death on the day of the armistice in 1918, with the crowd shouting, "Abba Guillaume," and Apollinaire, in his delirium, thinking they were crying against him. And I thought, I will do my best to serve her and see she gets justice for the good work she had done as long as I can. So help me God and Mike Ney. But the hell with her lost generation talk and all the dirty, easy labels. When I got home and into the courtyard and upstairs and saw my wife and my son and his cat, F-Puss, all of them happy, and a fire in the fireplace, I said to my wife, "You know, Gertrude is nice, anyway."
"Of course, Tati.
But she does talk a lot of rot sometimes."
"I never hear her," my wife said. "I'm a wife. It's her friend that talks to me."
8. Hunger was good discipline. You got very hungry when you did not eat enough in Paris, because all the bakery shops had such good things in the windows, and people ate outside at tables on the sidewalk so that you saw and smelled the food. When you were skipping meals at a time when you had given up journalism and were writing nothing that anyone in America would buy, explaining at home that you were lunching out with someone, the best place to do it was the Luxembourg Gardens, where you saw and smelled nothing to eat all the way from the Place de l'Observatoire to the Rue de Vaugirard. There you could always go into the Luxembourg Museum, and all the paintings were heightened and clearer and more beautiful if you were belly empty, hollow hungry. I learned to understand Cézanne much better and to see truly how he made landscapes when I was hungry. I used to wonder if he were hungry too when he painted, but I thought it was possibly only that he had forgotten to eat. It was one of those unsound but illuminating thoughts you have when you have been sleepless or hungry. Later, I thought Cézanne was probably hungry in a different way. After you came out of the Luxembourg, you could walk down the narrow Rue Ferou to the Place Saint-Sulpice, and there were still no restaurants, only the quiet square with its benches and trees. There was a fountain with lions, and pigeons walked on the pavement and perched on the statues of the bishops. There was the church, and there were shops selling religious objects and vestments on the north side of the square. From this square you could not go further toward the river without passing shops selling fruits, vegetables, wines, or bakery and pastry shops. But by choosing your way carefully you could work to your right around the gray and white stone church and reach the Rue de l'Odéon, and turn up to your right toward Sylvia Beach's bookshop, and on your way you did not pass too many places where things to eat were sold. The Rue de l'Odéon was bare of eating places until you reached the square where there were 3 restaurants. By the time you reached 12 Rue de l'Odéon, your hunger was contained, but all of your perceptions were heightened again. The photographs looked different, and you saw books that you had never seen before. "You're too thin, Hemingway," Sylvia would say. "Are you eating enough?"
"Sure."
"What did you eat for lunch?"
My stomach would turn over and I would say, "I'm going home for lunch now."
"At 3 o'clock?"
"I didn't know it was that late."
"Adrienne said the other night she wanted to have you and Hadley for dinner. We'd ask Farg. You like Farg, don't you? Or Larbeau? You like him. I know you like him. Or anyone you really like. Will you speak to Hadley?"
"I know she'd love to come."
"I'll send her a panneau. Don't you work so hard now that you don't eat properly."
"I won't."
"Get home now before it's too late for lunch."
"They'll save it."
"Don't eat cold food either. Eat a good hot lunch."
"Did I have any mail?"
"I don't think so, but let me look."
She looked and found a note and looked up happily and then opened a closed door in her desk.
"This came while I was out," she said.
It was a letter, and it felt as though it had money in it.
"Vaderkop," Sylvia said.
"It must be from der Kversnit. Did you see Vaderkop?"
"No, but he was here with George. He'll see you, don't worry. Perhaps he wanted to pay you first."
"It's 600 francs. He says there will be more."
"I'm awfully glad you reminded me to look. Dear Mr. Awfully Nice."
"It's damn funny that Germany is the only place I can sell anything. To him and the Frankfurter Zeitung."
"Isn't it? But don't you worry ever. You can sell stories to Ford," she teased me.
30 francs a page. Say 1 story every 3 months in the Transatlantic. Story 5 pages long, make 150 francs a quarter, 600 francs a year.
"But Hemingway, don't worry about what they bring now. The point is that you can write them."
"I know. I can write them, but nobody will buy them. There is no money coming in since I quit journalism."
They will sell. Look, you have the money for one right